ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, Dr. Carl here. Back in 1986, I could not wait to see teacher Krista McAuliffe on the Space Shuttle Challenger launch into space.
Roger, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
We could not believe what we were seeing. The Challenger Legacy. To hear more, search for Science Fiction and look out for The Challenger Legacy. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
A year ago, some of our greatest economic minds forecast a recession in the US, with reverberations spreading to China and much of the rest of the world, and in Australia, low and tamed inflation, with only modest house price growth. That isn't how it worked out. US economic growth accelerated, the US and other share markets soared, and in Australia, home prices took off again as a resurgence in inflation pushed real wage growth back down to zero. It's enough to make you feel uneasy, which is why we're about to tempt fate and try to work out what's in store for us in the year to come. Are we headed for good times or bad times? And does the answer depend, more than at most times, on who we are? Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and my guest this week at the start of the economic year, Amy Oster, who's had to grapple with these questions in the economic divisions of the Australian Treasury, the Victorian Treasury and the ANZ Bank, and who now runs the new think tank Policy Institute Australia, and Ben Phillips, an economic modeller and specialist in housing, who's principal research fellow at the ANU Centre for Social Research and Methods. Welcome back, Amy, and welcome back, Ben.
Great to be here, Peter.
Thanks, Peter. Lovely to be here.
Amy, before we get to the year ahead, can you explain the year just passed? The US didn't have an economic collapse, was it? Because for once the US got the knack of taming inflation without bringing on a recession. Was it because Trump chickened out repeatedly on tariff hikes? Or was it because there's not really that much damage one person can do?
What Trump has done on tariffs is damaging. There's no question about it. It just takes a little while for that, well, some time for that damage to be felt. There were things that went right in the U.S. So in terms of inflation, the Federal Reserve did raise interest rates, and that had the desired impact on headline and overall inflation. Now, Trump, last year, you'd have to say, was a net positive for the U.S. economy.
What?
True. The tariffs are problematic, but the problem with tariffs is not going to be felt in 2025, or maybe not even in 2026. But what was felt was the huge tax cuts, the big, beautiful bill, the fiscal expansion, and all of the buoyancy into the share market that came from the rate cuts and Trump's support for financial markets after the 9th of April, when the bond markets kind of gave him a lashing. The other aspects of, if you like, Trumponomics actually did stimulate growth. The downside is something that's yet to be felt.
It would also be true that the extraordinary growth in AI-related stocks cushioned whatever damage might have happened, I guess.
Well, it certainly helped with the buoyancy of the stock market, no question about it, to the point where people were starting to be concerned about an AI bubble. And that does feed through to the economy to some extent through the wealth effect. But employment is strong, inflation has gone down, and consumption has returned, and productivity is lifting. So the U.S. economy is doing well despite what's happened with tariffs.
Might we be able to see the sort of big event that causes big problems that we were expecting last year?
I think we will, but it's a question of the lag. So when we have a financial market collapse, say the global financial crisis or even the tech wreck or Black Monday back in 1987, that is a shock. Everybody sees it. It's like a kitchen fire. You have to put it out, and it's very evident that it happened. Tariff wars are more like carbon monoxide. They take a long
time. They kill, but not straight away.
It's a slow, painful leak. So we can look at the case of Brexit. It's our most recent example of an unexpected and sudden increase in friction in cross-border trade.
At that time, all sorts of people were saying the UK economy will tank. It didn't at the time.
It didn't at the time. But research that's been put out just last month from economists at Bank of England, Stanford, and King's College showed they've estimated that GDP reduced by 6 to 8% since in the 10 years since Brexit, or is 6 to 8% lower than it would have been had Brexit not occurred. That productivity and employment are both 3 to 4 percentage points lower. So the impact accumulates over time. It's just more gradual and harder to observe.
Trump is damaging the U.S. economy, but slowly, probably after his term, if his term ends when it's meant to. Ben, can I ask about us? A year ago in Australia, inflation was coming down. Home price growth was easing. It was even falling, home prices, at the end of last year. Then the Reserve Bank cut interest rates 3 times. Inflation took off. It's now above the Reserve Bank's target band instead of in the middle of it. And home prices turned back up. In the past year, they've climbed 8.6%. What's the message? Is it that prices, especially home prices, are very hard to restrain in Australia?
Yes. Well, I think as always, Peter, it's very hard to know exactly what's going on with the housing market and house prices. But certainly we did see during that last year, we did see a bit of a return to house price growth, perhaps not as strong as some other periods we've seen, but certainly some return there. And I guess that's partly because a few factors. So interest rates coming down, or at least a view that interest rates were going to come down and come down a fair bit. There's also been some policies by various governments, particularly the federal government, with the new home 5% deposit scheme.
That's put some pressure into house prices, although that doesn't apply to expensive houses, but that's put pressure in at the middle and bottom end, has it?
That seems to be the case. So there was some interesting analysis, I think, of Cotality house price data, I think. I could be wrong on that. But they did look at sort of the bottom half of the market, the top half of the market, where those price cut-in points are for the 5% deposit scheme. And they did find that lower house prices, their growth was stronger than higher house price or higher house price areas. So that is kind of interesting. But what's interesting, I guess, at the moment is that we don't think interest rates are about to drop. We think, if anything, they might even increase through 2026, although that's very hard to know. And house prices, they do move as in response to, I guess, expectations around interest rates. And if the expectation is not that they're going to fall anytime soon, that might be something that does slow down the house price growth that we've seen of late. But the other force is, of course, that home deposit scheme, which I think Treasury initially thought was going to be quite small in terms of its impact. But I guess we'll have to wait and see where that really lands.
Is it also that we're really quite well off? Those real wage growth figures don't show it, but unemployment has come down. We've got far more of us with money, even if those of us who are earning money aren't earning that much more of it.
Households are doing reasonably well, and that's always a useful factor in terms of continuing to push house prices along. And as much as we talk about interest rates, perhaps, you know, they might be going up a little bit, they're still pretty low historically. We had much higher interest rates, say 15 or 20 years ago, than what we have today.
Are we generally insulated from the United States, perhaps more than we might have thought a year ago, because our economy works differently?
Yeah, look, it seems to be that that might be the case, although I do take the points that Amy mentioned, that perhaps things like the changes in tariffs, that might take a while to filter through. So I think there was a bit of a doomsday scenarios around what was going to happen with Trump. And at this point, that hasn't happened, and it has been a while that he's been in now. But maybe Amy's right. Maybe the impacts around the global economy will be felt more in this year and in subsequent years.
Is China more important to us, Amy, than the US? At the moment?
Economically, absolutely, and it's been that way for a long time. Global prices are really important for our economy. But in terms of direct economic relationship, it is definitely more China and the rest of Asia. You know, Japan is a very important market for a number of our large exports, much more so than the United States directly.
should we be worried about what's happening in China? We're relying a lot on China getting economic management right. The IMF this week predicted weaker economic growth in China, down from 5% to 4% next year. China's population has shrunk for the fourth consecutive year.
China's growth is slowing, but that was always going to happen because you sort of reach a level and you can't continue to accelerate your growth from a level. You know, the economy is now so large that the rate of growth is going to slow. But similarly, the magnitude, the stock, or the size of the commodities that we sell to China is now so huge that it will remain in that support for our economy. So just the volume is large. The outlook for commodity prices seems to be pretty good. Global demand for next year, as according to current forecasts, and we have to remind ourselves that they are just forecasts, as you were saying, is pretty good. And don't forget, it's iron ore, but also LNG and agricultural exports and coal. So we have a resources mix. And our terms of trade remains very high.
Ben, in Australia, along with the cries of anguish from homebuyers who are unable to get into the market, we've heard an awful lot about how hard it has become to rent. Advertised rents are said to have climbed 44% over the past 5 years. You have a longer-term view than others, and you're a specialist in housing. You've followed it for a long time. You think that for most renters, there isn't a crisis. Why is that?
Yeah, so I think over the long term, I don't think too much has changed with the rental market. It's certainly true that
a lot of people would not like to hear that because they're facing very big increases in advertised rents.
No, I think you called me one of Australia's most unpopular economists when I said that last time I was on your show, Peter. And look, I think over the long term, the rental market in Australia has actually been pretty stable. Now, that might seem at odds with some of the statistics that we hear. So you do hear a lot about advertised rents, and they certainly are inflated. So what that means is that for the small number of people who are, say, changing house or they're getting into the rental market for the first time, they may well find that prices are elevated, or at least the advertised prices that they see. Advertised prices aren't actually always final prices, though. But when we look at the overall market, which is what the ABS looks at, and we do take into account, say, things like changes in rent assistance, we do find that rent growth has been, if anything, relatively sluggish compared to the rest of the economy in terms of, say, wages, or in particular, the CPI overall. So over the past 20 or 30 years, not too much has changed. Rates of rental stress are perhaps a little bit elevated at the moment, but there's not that much in it. So it's statistically not that much different to any other time in the last sort of 20 or 30 years, which perhaps would be surprising.
So for a typical renter, it's what, 25% of their income is spent on rent just as it used to be?
Yeah, so I think it increased in the 80s and early 90s, but certainly the last 30 years, that number's been very, very static. It's been about 25% of after-tax or disposable income.
What would it take to get people into homes? The Senate is inquiring into the generous capital gains tax treatment available for property investors. Would removing that concession or winding it back help?
Perhaps that's a little more generous than it needs to be. So some have talked about winding it back from 50% to, say, 40% or even 25%. And there might be some reasonable arguments around that. It may make some difference, but I don't think that would make an enormous difference. I don't see how it would really improve rental affordability. It may lower house prices a little bit. And I guess that has some indirect impact there in terms of having more home buyers and fewer renters. But I think the impacts would probably be relatively small. And I think, obviously, politically quite challenging all of these things are.
Would you do it, Amy?
I think on those grounds of kind of equity and tax progressivity, it makes sense. Whether it would significantly impact the housing market, I think, you know, maybe jury's out on that. My number one tax reform directed at housing would be the stamp duty to land tax swap. And that's something that I would love to see the Commonwealth fund states to do.
This is something that states have to do because it is states that charge stamp duty. Replacing it with land tax, the Commonwealth could, and we used when you were on the program last time, used the word bribe to describe the way the Commonwealth can financially encourage states to do things that the Commonwealth wants them to do. That could help. Your state, Victoria, is actually imposing a land tax separately from that swap. And that ought to be a good thing, right? Because it'll make it less attractive to hold land instead of use it.
The series of land taxes that the government of Victoria has imposed on landholders, yes, it is meant to make it more expensive to hold land, to hold vacant land, to hold homes that are vacant, also to have an Airbnb property. That's meant to discourage investment properties to become more and more expensive, which is happening, and to therefore, I guess, induce to put them up on the market so that people can own them as homes. But that is not nearly as effective as getting rid of stamp duty.
What about building more homes? The government has a target of 1.2 million homes over 5 years. It looks as if that won't be anything like achieved. What could it do to speed things up?
Construction industry productivity is woeful. It is woeful. And anybody who's really interested in this, I encourage you to have a read of the Queensland Productivities Commission interim report on what's happened with labour productivity and construction and the impacts of it. So they've estimated that in Queensland, labour productivity has risen only 5% since 1995, as against 65% for the Queensland economy as a whole. Since 2018, productivity has fallen 9%. And if productivity had remained flat since 2018, it would meet what is currently viewed as workforce shortages in the construction industry. So the Queensland Productivity Commission was looking at what are the causes of poor labor productivity. And one of the main ones that they found is, if you like, the crowding out in the construction sector, where residential construction has been crowded out by major project infrastructure construction, or what's called civil construction. The civil construction market has grown hugely because of all of the investment from government in infrastructure.
These are roads, railways, the Olympic Stadium. These sort of things take workers away from building houses, because someone who's constructing one of those could just as easily be constructing a home.
Well, there's two things to this. One is, yes, take workers away, but also the important thing has changed working conditions. And what the Queensland Productivity Commission has suggested is change working conditions so that we are getting less output per worker, i.e. a drag in productivity. They've reported that there are a number of major project sites in Queensland that only operate 3 days a week. Out of five.
Workers are paid for five.
Yes. This is the impact of RDOs and weather events and other things that come along and shut down sites. And this has been documented elsewhere, especially scheduling issues, rostering, RDOs, other terms and conditions that have come on, so that the productivity per worker is just not nearly what it used to be in civil construction, but then that those terms and conditions filter through into residential construction. And what the commission said, if conditions remain as they are, what it means from now till 2030 is 26,500 fewer homes being constructed. So they have calculated this per-day productivity loss and estimated based on that you're talking 26,000 fewer homes.
Ben, what would you do to maybe achieve that government target of 1.2 million more homes? Or do you think it's really not possible?
It just looked to me very unlikely to be met. And we're now, roughly speaking, in terms of building approvals, I suppose about halfway through that target. And we're about 70 to 75% of where we need to be. And that's probably about what I expected would have happened. So I've never really thought that target was going to be met. I thought a million might have been a more realistic target. We'll probably get to about 900,000, which is obviously not anywhere near 1.2 million. The other thing is, if you had that additional build, which would be well in excess of what sort of population growth suggests we need, you might have a bit of a hangover effect into the future as well. So I'm a little bit skeptical about the supply measures happening, just because I think builders want to build when there's strong house price inflation. When there's not, they're not so keen to build. So
you're saying house prices aren't high enough almost to get that level of building?
I think to build in Australia, very often what you see is that when house prices are growing, home building is strong, and that's because builders can see that when they buy their land, they're going to sell it at a profit, and they're going to be able to sell it, and they're going to be able to get pre-sales. And if you've got house prices that are dropping, investors won't be as excited about the property market. So I think there's the property cycle is probably more determined by demand factors than it is by supply factors. I do take Amy's comments into account there that, yes, there's certainly some structural issues with the home building industry. But I also do think that really just about 5 or 6 years ago, we were building at extremely strong levels. So we were building about 210,000, 220,000 homes per year. At the moment, we're about 175,000. And that's well above what the average was, say, in years gone by. So we can build at strong levels, but a lot of that depends on how strong is the demand in the market.
Would cutting immigration help, Amy?
Well, I don't think recent experience bears that out. We closed our borders for pretty much 3 years during COVID, and I didn't see house prices plummet or demand for housing fall. I think we should just take that one off the table. Aside from the fact that if you reduce population growth, reduction in net migration is an immediate cut to economic growth. So you introduce a negative cycle unnecessarily.
So we're looking at complex interactions, which is what we do on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National. With me, Peter Martin, our guest this week, nutting out the year ahead, Amy Oster, who's doing it at the newly formed Policy Institute, and economic modeller and housing specialist Ben Phillips at the Australian National University. Ben, if there's anything we need to do to help things turn out well in the year ahead and the years to come, now is probably the time. This year, perhaps in the May budget, it'll be the first budget back after the election. That's the ideal time to set things up for the future. What would be on your list?
So a few things for me, Peter. I would like to see some tax reform. We have a system in Australia where perhaps workers are paying a little bit too much tax, and retirees, so older Australians, typically are paying not enough tax. We don't pay enough tax, potentially through housing. That's probably very controversial. When I say that, I'm talking about owner-occupiers as well. So the Treasury
puts
that.
You mean tax on the family home?
That's correct, Peter, yes. So,
of course, it needn't be all family homes. You could do it for increases in value above so many million.
You could. You could make it very progressive. So it probably, you could do this in a number of ways. So, and you could do it that it's that the taxation occurs at death. Some would call it death duties or death taxes. You could do it as capital gains tax. You could do it as a land tax, which I think Amy sort of already alerted to earlier in the show. So that's sort of some areas I would look at. I think the Treasury puts out its tax concession statement, and that's sometimes a controversial statement, but there's about $60 billion worth of tax concessions for superannuation and about the same amount for owner-occupier housing. I don't believe we'd get anything like that with some serious and good quality reform, but there's some serious amount of money, and I would call it low-hanging fruit, that could be achieved in terms of getting some additional tax through those sources or through wealth, as opposed to, say, personal income tax, which, say, for a young family with, say, you might have a mum and dad both working and you've got kids in school or kids in childcare, that's where the real financial pinch points are, not so much at retirement. So I would look at taxing more older Australians and a little less the working age Australians.
Tax reform is always the top of list. You know, you get a group of economists together and you're talking about one of two things. Either you're talking about road user charging or you're talking about tax reform. Economists love road user charging. This budget, because it is the, if you like, the midterm budget, it's the budget that could set out true ambition for reform. There's many ways that we can build our resilience, and making sure that our economy is strong and that we are able to carry our own weight and that we can go forward with confidence in our own economy, I think is the best response to what's happening internationally. So that was, you know, my three things in that context. Obviously, people will look to the budget season. So we have the Commonwealth budget, which is the midterm budget. We also have basically the pre-election budgets for Victoria and New South Wales, which have elections next year. So it's going to be a big budget season. My second thing is reinvigorate competition policy, because that is the best way to restore dynamism to our economy. And my third one is to sort out energy policy. That's my wish list for the year.
Ben, you're a member of the government's Economic Inclusion Advisory Committee. It reports to the Treasurer before each budget. For the last three reports, you've recommended big increases in JobSeeker and in rent assistance. And the government's gone some of the way, more on rent assistance than job seeker. Are you hopeful this time, given where we are in the political cycle?
Look, I'm unfortunately not particularly hopeful, but I would certainly like to see a substantial increase in the job seeker payment. The government has done some good work with rent assistance. They've increased it by about 25%, which is certainly very helpful. There's a very small increase in job seeker by the government a couple of years ago, but not nearly enough. So we want the payment to be around about 90% of the age pension, which would put it at a bit over $1,000 per fortnight. It's currently about nearly just under $800 per fortnight. So it's a fairly substantial increase, but I think it's a payment that's been too low for too long.
Shouldn't it be higher than the age pension? I ask that because when I look around me, I see people who are searching for jobs having greater expenses than pensioners.
Look, I think that's a good point, Peter. It certainly is the case that, say, an unemployed person or family would have a much higher cost of living than, say, a pensioner, an age pensioner.
And it's about 70% now of the pension.
It's just under 70% of the age pension. So age pensioners, they also tend to have a lot more wealth. Not all of them, but most of them have some wealth, whereas those on JobSeeker usually have next to no wealth as well. So it's not just that the costs are higher, it's also they've got less reserves as well. So they're a group that does need a lot of support, and they're not really being provided an adequate level of support at this point.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers, I hope you are listening to all of those suggestions. Before we go, as is traditional on the program, any quick final thoughts to leave us with? Anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Amy?
Through the year, we have the Productivity Commission reviewing GST. And the interim report comes out in August. So very interesting timing just
this
before the Victorian.
This is the special deal that advantages Western Australia.
Yes, this is the 2018 change to the GST legislation that has seen it's cost taxpayers about $36 billion so far. It's under review. Review interim report in August ahead of the Victorian election in November. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic.
Ben, what are you looking out for?
Yeah, so in terms of, I guess, over this year, I'm looking for the budget, really. I'm interested to see whether there's that shift in the job seeker payment, and also whether there's more of a reformist approach to the economy, to tax and welfare and some other parts. So that's where I'll be looking the most this year. Obviously, as we discussed, it's probably the best time for the government to do it. And I guess if it doesn't do it now, you'd have to ask, when would it do it? And is it really a reformist government or not?
No, there's so much I didn't get to. And Ben, I back you up. I didn't get a chance to talk about getting social transfers under control.
Oh, that's okay.
Which are not progressive, as opposed to our welfare system, which is highly progressive.
Well, they are certainly not targeted.
No.
Yeah. We've certainly gone down a path, I think, which is sort of politically convenient to spend money more on, say, things like Medicare or NDIS childcare, and it goes to everybody, which is nice, but there's some who need it much more desperately than people like myself.
100%. We were the most targeted country in the world, generally. Peter Whiteford, you know, wrote about that in the 90s. I don't know whether we are.
We are not.
Anthony Albanese, we hope you're listening too. Amy Oster, Head of Policy Institute Australia, and Ben Phillips, Principal Research Fellow at the Australian National University Centre for Social Research and Methods. Thank you both so much.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Peter.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays and now Saturday morning as well. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid, you can email us. Listener Andy has done that via theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. He describes our show at the beginning of this year on whether Australia should become an energy superpower as, quote, the best podcast I've heard in the past 11 months. Brilliant. Thank you, Andy. We're getting a lot of response as well to our show of a fortnight ago on the housing crisis. Seriously, they are both worth re-listens. Thanks today to producer Hayley Crane. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.